Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Jobs and Labor Conference Committee. I call this meeting to order. This remote hearing is being conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01 of House Rule, and this remote hearing can be viewed on the House webcast. With that, I wanted to ask everyone, please mute your mics as we go through the discussions. Mr. Rees, if you can call members to make sure that we do have members and senators ready to go with our conversation today.
Sure. Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Hamilton.
Present.
I'll start with Senator Rarick.
Present.
Senator Dreheim.
Present.
Senator Pratt.
Present.
Senator Eakin.
Present.
And Senator Housley. Mr. Chair, I have not seen Senator Housley check in yet, but we do have a quorum, and I'll note when Senator Housley does join.
Thank you so much, Mr. Rees. We do have a quorum, so we will begin with public testimony for those who were unable to testify yesterday, followed by the adoption of same and similar provisions. And then we will have discussion on the House position for sections that we did not complete on the first day to do a walkthrough and answer any questions from the members and senators. With that, I wanted to begin with the testifiers. The first person on my list is Mr. Ibarra. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and committee members. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. For the record, my name is David Ibarra. I am president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association, an organization representing more than 9,000 men and women working in various piping-related industries, including plumbers, pipe fitters, sprinkler fitters, and service technicians working in all sectors of the construction industry. I thank you for allowing me to appear before you this morning to offer testimony on two of the provisions that are important to the members I am fortunate to represent. Minnesota Pipe Trades Association strongly supports the Safe and Skilled Workforce Act. There have already been multiple testifiers that have spoken in favor of this provision, so my comments on this topic will be brief. This bill is about safety for first responders, for the workers in these facilities, as well as the communities in close proximity. As stated in the letter I submitted to the committee, it is universally acknowledged that apprenticeship training programs represent excellence in workforce development and implement the best in-class safety and skill curricula that make construction trade members the best in the world with respect to productivity, safety, efficiency, and quality. Apprenticeship requirements are excellent public policy, especially in inherently dangerous work locations like petroleum refineries. I would like to thank Representative Lissegaard and Senator Bigham for authoring this legislation. The other provision I would like to speak to is Chair Noor's bill, House File 109, a bill that requires automatic sprinklers in high-rise buildings. As you know, this language comes to the legislature in response to the tragic high-rise fire that killed five Minnesotans in November of 2019. The state fire marshal has testified that since 2004, there have been 65 fires in Minnesota that started on or above the seventh floor of a building, the vast majority of them being multifamily high-rise dwellings. In cases where fire suppression sprinklers were present, all fires were quickly contained or extinguished. Conversely, the fire marshal has concluded that the lack of an automatic sprinkler system in the apartment where the fire originated in November 2019 was a major factor in the deaths that occurred. In short, it is universal opinion of firefighting professionals that automatic fire suppression systems in high-rise buildings save lives. I again thank Chair Noor and Senator Dziedzic for authoring similar legislation on this topic and respectfully request that this, along with the Safe and Skilled Workforce Act, are included included as the conference committee moves through the process. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bryan, also for keeping it short. So to the testifiers, please keep it to 2 minutes and make sure that we allow other individuals to testify. With that, the next person on the list is Mrs. Jacobson. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and the committee members. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Patty Jacobson. I live in Ramsey, Minnesota. I have been a pipefitter for 23 years, and I was out at St. Paul Park for 2 years. I've had a long career. I spent 4 years at another refinery, and a couple years at St. Paul Park was from 2018 to 2020. The first thing that I observed was that it was very different than my other experience. If even a teaspoon or a tablespoon of any type of product were to leak or hit the ground, you were to record it, have it cleaned, follow the procedure. I never seen that happen once in the 2 years that I was out there. And after Marathon took over, it actually got worse. The other thing, I could tell you a lot of stories about safety hazards that were extremely concerning. For example, we would have danger tape up when we would do supplied air, and oftentimes other crafts or the people who were brought in for turnaround would walk right through it, to the point where we would actually have to have people stand around our danger tape so that nobody would enter it and get hurt. Or a supplied air tape. Also, it was even scarier when there were blinds installed during turnaround for the region, and the blinds act as a seal. It seals the vessel so that no heat, no pyrophoric, no flammable gases can get out. We did not install the blinds, but the other contractors that were brought in for turnaround had to leave. So often we would have to go and blind them or go and remove the blinds and rehook up the vessel. And then on more than one occasion, we would get to the blind and it would have an air gap. It didn't have the right size to match what it was. If it was an RTJ flange, they would just have a not a conversion gasket. They would have a regular gasket and not even have removed it. So we would be going up to do a supplied air job and we'd literally be able to see through it. The tags were burned off. People would have been really hurt if they walked up on that catwalk. The studs weren't tightened. They didn't even have a full nut, which as a pipe fitter, I mean, that's you should have that as just a first year apprentice information from where I come from. In the Elkey, we did both maintenance and projects. And for a maintenance job, we were supposed to go and fix something in the HF Elkey unit. And I was called at 7 o'clock that morning and told I could not go in there because there was a leak. So that same day at 1:30, our 1:30 meeting, I was asked by the same exact person who called me from Marathon. I was asked why I didn't go in there, and I simply stated because you called me earlier and told me that we cannot go in the HF Elkey unit because there was a leak. And he said, who called you? And I believe it was because he was under so much stress at that point that he couldn't even remember telling us we couldn't go in there. So I slid a note over to one of the people that we work closely with.
Ms. Jacobson, if you can please wrap up your testimony, I'll appreciate that.
Yep. Nope. And he didn't remember telling us. He seemed confused. And we left for a week because it wasn't safe to be there. I didn't feel safe for myself or the three crews that I had there. So we did leave. We were very lucky not to get hurt. And I hope things are done safer. I would like to thank you guys for your time and to the committee for letting me speak.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I also wanted to note Senator Housley is also present. I would like to invite the next person is Dr. Bruce Corey. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Dr. Corey?
Yeah, I got it. Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and members of the conference committee, thank you for this opportunity to share my perspective on the Omnibus Jobs and Business Development Bill. My name is Dr. Bruce Corey. I'm professor of economics at Concordia University and member of the ALANA Brain Trust, ALANA standing for African, Latino, Asian, and Native American. The House Select Committee on Racial Justice on Evaluating the Economic Cost of Racism, which I estimated to be at least $287 billion, recommended that the state do the following. Invest $1 billion in the ALANA wealth-building infrastructure in Minnesota. Leverage government spending by increasing contracts to ALANA businesses. Leverage the financial resources of the state. And keeping in mind that the scale of investment needed, given that there are over 50,000 ALANA businesses, many of them are early startups and need for technical assistance as well as patient capital. There are also close to 500,000 ALANA workers. How do we assess the progress in this omnibus bill? It's good to see trends reflected in the House bill. First, a focus on grants versus loans, as small and micro businesses do not have much capacity to take on new debt. Within these grant programs, there's something long overdue, a significant investment in ALANA female entrepreneurs, and a revolving loan fund with zero interest focused on micro entrepreneurs. Second is an intentional focus to transform existing and new programs, such as the realignment of the workforce funds, such that they are accessible to ALANA businesses and workers. All programs in the House and Senate bill should do the same. DEED is also providing disaggregated data, which is useful. Third is the building of the capacity of nonprofits from community-based organizations to CDCs and CDFIs. Fourth is the investment in much-needed childcare centers, especially in rural areas. Both the House and Senate bills invest in key ALANA business and workforce organization. The Senate bill focused on a $100 million loan guarantee program needs to prioritize ALANA businesses to be effective. There's also a need for big finance tools to help support ALANA developers as they face a crippling capital shortage. We also need to provide an alternative finance system of funds to serve needs of businesses that require alternatives to interest-based loans. We also need to invest in land banks and land trusts as a strategy against gentrification. I appreciate the movement towards a comprehensive strategy to grow wealth in the ALANA communities. ALANA Brain Trust will support you in this effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. The next person is Mr. Ben Wedeman. Please welcome and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Wedeman, and for a decade, I was a health, safety, environmental manager for a large contractor that specializes in maintenance and construction work inside refineries, power plants, and chemical plants throughout the U.S. I have experience in each of these high-hazard facilities, but my main work was focused in one of the oil refineries right here in Minnesota. I was responsible for developing and reviewing safety policies and procedures, writing job hazard analysis for specific jobs, job audits, incident investigations, and developing corrective actions. Also working with Minnesota OSHA and taking injured employees to emergency care if needed. In short, as health and safety manager at a refinery, my highest priority was to ensure that every day all employees return home safe to their families. Oil refineries are a high hazard work environment. That is a fancy way of saying it's a very dangerous place to work. It's dangerous for employees, it's dangerous for their coworkers, and potentially dangerous to surrounding community and environment. Hands down, nothing increases the safe operation of a refinery more than a well-trained workforce. I can spot the difference between workers that are trained in registered apprenticeship programs and those that are not. It's night and day. The apprenticeship program workers understand their specific job duties. They know what they don't know and what questions to ask. They contribute to a safe and productive culture of work every day. It's good business and cheap insurance to have a high level of training for workers in these high hazard work environments. And today I ask for your help to ensure the safety of refinery workers, the environment, and the general public. For my dollar, nothing is more important than ensuring contracted work in refineries is performed by workers trained through registered apprenticeships. Passing the Safe and Skilled Workforce Act is the right thing for lawmakers to do. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on the list is Mr. Franco. Please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chairs Knorr and Pratt and members of the committee. My name is Lucas Franco, for the record. I'm the research manager for LAUNA, Minnesota and North Dakota. I'm also the co-author of a recent report on safety conditions at the St. Paul Park Refinery, which is included as an agenda attachment and can be found at localjobsnorth.org. Along with my co-author, I've spent the last 8 weeks or so analyzing public documents and interviewing workers in an effort to better understand conditions at the facility. What we uncovered was frankly scary. Worker after worker shared stories of potential safety, health, and environmental hazards, from clearly improper installation of fire safety controls to obviously botched cleanup operations. Workers told us that the St. Paul Park refinery has been troubled for years, but they fear recent actions taken by Marathon may have made the facility more dangerous. These actions include elimination of safety tech and firefighter positions, removal of skilled local trades workforce, and finally locking out of operations workforce. Workers reported numerous cases of avoidable safety lapses that were clearly the result of poor management or use of poorly trained workforce, or both. Their eyewitness reports indicate that Marathon has brought in non-local workers who clearly lack a basic knowledge of their jobs, refinery hazards, and or safety procedures. And as shocking as these accounts are in the report, we are concerned that they could be just the tip of the iceberg. In a refinery, a seemingly minor mistake can have serious consequences for workers and for surrounding communities. At St. Paul Park, these risks include exposure to hydrogen fluoride, or HF. An EPA analysis found that a crack in an HF tank at St. Paul Park could unleash a toxic plume that could travel up to 19 miles, as far as Newport or downtown Minneapolis or Burnsville, potentially endangering as many as 1.7 million Minnesotans. The best thing policymakers can do to protect refinery workers and neighboring communities is to require rigorous training standards for the contracted workforce. The Safe and Skilled Workforce Act sets a critical threshold for work in a refinery. This legislation is sorely needed in light of what we believe are deteriorating safety conditions at the St. Paul Park refinery. I encourage you to take our findings seriously and to support the Safe and Skilled Workforce Act. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person on the list is Mr. Alsett. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Good morning, Chair Knorr, Chair Pratt, and Conference Committee members. My name is Randy Alseth, and I am the Chief Executive Officer for Wellia Health in Mora, Minnesota. We serve patients throughout East Central Minnesota. Our mission is to help those we care for live life well. I am here today to express my opposition to a provision in the House bill mandating paid leave for essential workers. This past year has been challenging for hospitals. Our expenses have gone up, preparing and caring for COVID patients, but our volumes have gone down, particularly for some of our elective surgical procedures. We are hopeful that this situation is starting to change. However, it's made for quite challenging times. We have 540 employees. As you are likely aware, the federal government is providing financial credits to help pay for paid leave benefits for essential workers, but only for employers with less than 500 employees. Wellia Health just missed the cutoff threshold to qualify for federal financial assistance. I have estimated that the 80 hours of retroactive benefit going back to March of 2020 will cost my organization over $500,000, and the prospective 80 hours paid leave benefit could cost even more. These are very significant costs to Wellia Health. In addition to the cost, this will be an administrative nightmare for accounting and HR departments trying to figure out this benefit on a retroactive basis and paying it back fairly. Implementing the new 80 hours of mandated paid leave moving forward is also a concern. This would be an unfair benefit to those of our staff who have been vaccinated and are following CDC and MDH guidelines. Obviously, they and their families would be much less likely to contract COVID-19. Wellia Health is a great place to work, and we will continue to provide a very good and competitive benefit package for our employees. Just to be clear, every Wellia Health employee has been paid for all necessary leave related to COVID-19. Please do not force this unfunded mandate on us. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Mr. Cron. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, as you said, my name is Eric Cron. I'm a window cleaner, and I represent a lot of other window cleaners and as an executive on the board for SIU Local 26. I'm here to testify in opposition Article 2, Section of the SEDIC language, which would roll back fall protections for window cleaners by getting rid of the requirement for roof anchors on some buildings with sloped roofs. I want to thank Senator Housley for organizing a meeting with us in March to talk to her constituent who's requesting.
Mr. Cron,
unfortunately, he wasn't open to our suggestions.
So Mr. Cron,
what's that?
We're having some technical issues from your side. If you can just remove the video and go with the just the audio only. Yep, go ahead.
Is that better?
Yes.
Unfortunately, as I was saying, he wasn't open to our suggestions, so I need to ask you to keep this change out of the final bill since it would make our jobs less safe. We heard that these anchors aren't needed since we can't access them on a slope roof. The thing is, it's not that simple. When we can't access them, it's because of bad decisions made by the builders, which doesn't make them unnecessary or unimportant. It just makes us less safe. In fact, we not only need these anchors, but we also need developers to keep with the spirit of the law and make them accessible, which could be through a hatch in the roof or a gable. Not all buildings are accessible by a scissor lift or even a boom. To use these, you need enough flat open space all the way around the building, which isn't always the case. And without roof anchors or being able to get a lift up to the building, I myself have had to throw a line over a pitched roof and tie off to a trailer hitch. And while that was the best I could manage, it wasn't a safe way of doing things. The current law passed in 2012 with a near unanimous support after three window cleaners in the metro area had fell to their deaths. But since this became the law, we haven't had any falling deaths by window cleaners in Minnesota. Like with any other safety code, we shouldn't be rolling this back without a full process and agreement of everyone involved. So please keep Article 2, Section 9 of the Senate language out of the final bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person that I have on the list is Mr. Mercado, with the translation provided by Ms. Smith. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Buenos días. Gracias, señor presidente, por este tiempo. Mi nombre es Odemaris Mercado y he sido conserje empleado por ABM para limpiar las oficinas de Cargill.
So, thank you for your time, Chair Noor. My name is Odemaris Mercado, and I have been a janitor employed by ABM to clean the offices of Cargill.
Durante 12 años y soy miembro de la local 26 CEIU.
And I have done that work for 12 years and I am a member of SEIU Local 26.
Y soy miembro de la junta directiva de mi sindicato.
And I am also the union's executive board of SEIU.
Yo tuve COVID en julio del año pasado.
I had COVID last July.
Estuve muy enferma y con mucho miedo.
I was very sick and I was very frightened.
Porque soy una persona que tengo diabetes 2, tengo asma.
Because I have diabetes 2 and have asthma.
y presión arterial.
And also high blood pressure.
Y estaba preocupada por mi familia.
And of course, I was worried about my family.
En un momento, mi médico me ordenó ir al hospital porque estaba falta de oxígeno.
At some point, my doctor ordered me to go to the hospital because I was lacking oxygen.
Ah, pero yo pensé, prefiero morir en mi casa a ir al hospital.
But I thought to myself, I'd rather die at home instead of going to the hospital.
En mi edificio, cinco personas dieron positivo a COVID.
At my building, five people gave their test that positive for COVID.
Y más 900 compañeros más en todo lo que es los trabajadores de limpieza.
And more than over 900 workers, janitor workers, also have had COVID.
Y cuatro de ellos murieron.
And four of them have passed away.
Nunca pudimos trabajar desde casa.
We have never been able to work from home.
Así que estuvimos en riesgo de contraer este virus todo el tiempo como trabajadores esenciales.
So we have been working under the risk that have this virus the whole time as frontline and essential workers.
Cuando contraje COVID,
when I got COVID,
me puse muy, muy, muy enferma.
I got very, very sick.
No trabajé durante un mes.
I didn't work for a month.
No tuve paga de ese mes.
And of course, I didn't get paid for that month.
Los únicos que me ayudaron fue el local 26. Me dio $3.
The only help that I got was through my union, SEIU Local 26. I got $300.
Yo tuve que acudir a llamar a personas para que me ayudaran, amigos míos para que me ayudaran a lo de la renta, a comprar comida.
I have to ask some friends to help me with some money for me to be able to buy food and pay my rent.
Y aún estoy luchando por pagar alquiler y los biles.
Emma, to tell you the truth, I'm still struggling to pay my bills and to pay my rent.
Hoy, en el artículo 12 de parte de licencia de emergencia del proyecto de ley.
So I'm speaking today in support of Article 12, the emergency leave portion of the House bill.
No creo que la gente trabajadora deba ser castigada por enfermarse.
I don't think the hard working people should be punished for getting sick.
No deberíamos perder el salario.
We should not lose our wages.
Porque nos quedamos en casa para mantener.
Because we stay home to keep our families
saludables a nuestras familias y a nuestra comunidad.
To keep our families and communities healthy.
Esta ley debe ser aprobada.
This law should be passed.
Y debe incluir el pago retroactivo de quienes faltaron al trabajo durante el último año.
And this law should include the back pay for those who missed work over the last year.
Ms. Mercado, if you can wrap up your testimony, I'll appreciate that. Thank you.
Señora Mercado, si podemos terminar rapidito más.
Okay. También quiero expresar mi apoyo al tiempo ganado por enfermedad.
I also want to express my support for the statewide earned sick and safe time.
Y seguridad en todo el estado.
For the whole state.
Porque incluso después de esta pandemia, las personas nunca deberían de tener que elegir entre la salud y su cheque.
Because even after this pandemic, people should not have to choose between health and their paycheck.
Espero que todos usen su poder.
I hope that you all use your power
y votos para apoyar a todos los trabajadores esenciales.
And your vote to support all the essential frontline workers.
Aprobando el pago de la licencia emergencia por COVID y el tiempo pagado por enfermedad. Muchísimas gracias.
Passing the emergency law, portion of the House bill, and also sick and earn sick and safe time for the whole state. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate also the interpretation provided by Ms. Smith. The next person on the list is Ms. Mendez-Moore. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Veronica Mendez-Moore. I am the co-director of CITUL, the Center of Workers United in Struggle. Thank you for having me here this morning. I'm here because I'm deeply concerned about any rolling back of any of the protections that were won previously around protecting workers from wage theft. Even what we were able to accomplish with previous passing of wage theft protection for workers still just sort of barely gets us, you know, it gets us like a little bit higher than the ground floor where we were, but we're still seeing significant wage theft, even with these new provisions. But if we roll them back, things are gonna get much worse. What we know, and I say this from, you know, 14 years of experience working at this organization where we see workers come in daily with concerns about wage theft, from all across a number of different industries, from retail, from restaurants, fast food, from construction, from janitorial, from industries just across the board, we see significant amounts of wage theft every year. And what we know to be true that's related to the wage theft protections and the way that they've actually helped us is that when workers have in writing, this is how much money you make, it significantly changes the conversation on the back end when employers are stealing wages. And I know all employers don't steal wages, but it's significant in a lot of these industries where workers are making close to or just above the minimum wage. And so just a worker having that protection and knowing that when I go to collect my paycheck, I am assured that I'm going to be getting the $14 an hour that I was promised, and I've got something in writing that can help hold my employer to that, is a significant protection, and it means a lot to workers, and plays a significant role in making sure that workers can get what they're owed. We also know that there are a number of employers that actually build into their business model wage theft, especially when we look at employers that are subcontracted to do work for clients, that they actually, we've seen, you know, looking at records through lawsuits where we've been able to gather information, that companies are actually underbidding, are bidding less than what they can actually afford, given the costs to run the business and the cost to pay workers. They're building wage theft into their model, and the result of that is that we see workers not being paid. And so knowing that there are fines and penalties that actually create an incentive for an employer to do the right thing makes a big difference. And it also makes a big difference for employers who want to do the right thing, who are in this market competing against employers who have built wage theft into their business model. So the way that things had been done previously were fines and penalties incredibly minimal. It's easy to build wage theft into your business model because you know not every worker is going to complain, and you really have no incentive to follow the law. So increased fines and penalties have been critically important to help reduce wage theft because it actually makes the employer have to take into account their bottom line when they're thinking about committing wage theft. And again, like I said, particularly for businesses who want to do the right thing, it's hard for them to compete, and they get pushed out of the market. They don't get that subcontracting job that they were also bidding for because somebody else can do it cheaper because they're intentionally stealing wages from workers. So that's why we need increased fines and penalties. Those are critical to helping curb wage theft. So say this,
Ms. Mendez-Moore, if you can please wrap up your testimony, I appreciate that.
Yep, I can wrap it up right there. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person I have is Ms. Dominguez. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Buenos días a todos. Mi nombre es Lucila Domínguez, miembro de TUL. Y yo estoy aquí porque en el transcurso que llevo trabajando más de 10 años en la industria de la limpieza en todas partes, yo tuve robo de salario y en todas era como no pagan, te quedan a deber. Te prometen un salario y a la vez, y al final, cuando terminan de trabajar, no pagan ese dinero.
Ms. Smith?
My name is good. Morning, Chair Noor. My name is Lucila Dominguez, and I am here. I work at CETUL, and before I worked at CETUL, I used to do some work and cleaning, and every job that I worked at, I had wage theft. I experienced wage theft. So this is something that needs to be done.
Basado a eso, hace dos años comenzamos una campaña muy fuerte con cientos de trabajadores para luchar para que paren este robo de salario.
So about 2 years ago, we started this campaign with the workers to stop the wage theft.
Y lo que pedimos ahí es que pusieran multas visibles y fuertes para trabajadores que pasan robando todo el tiempo a los trabajadores esenciales.
And part of this request and this campaign was to request very stiff fines and difficult, hard fines to all these employers who are still in the wages from the workers.
Una parte es que los patrones tienen que documentar todo lo que ellos ofrecen al trabajador, porque ha pasado mucho que siempre ellos dan una cantidad de robo de salario, que dan una cantidad, perdón, de pago, y al final no quieren pagar, y cuando intentan pagar solo te dan el salario mínimo.
And what needs to happen is that the employers have to have legitimate documentation of the benefits and the benefits and the time that the workers have worked, because if that doesn't happen, what ends up happening is that the workers go through wage theft very often.
Y también asegurar que cuando los patrones te llaman a trabajar, tiene que estar documentado cuándo comenzaste a trabajar, qué tiempo trabajaste, todo tiene que estar documentado, porque cuando tú ya reclamas algo como trabajador, si no hay algo que testifica que tú eso te ofrecieron, eso te dijeron, después no hay como reclamar esto.
So again, if there is no documentation from the side of the employer, like written in writing when the worker started their shift, when they finished their shift, if there is none of those things in writing, that's definitely wage theft. It's definitely going to happen.
Entonces, para mí es indignante saber ahora que quieren quitar esta ley cuando yo luché hace dos años por esta ley.
For me, it's really
ahora quieren quitar algo que con mucho esfuerzo lograste.
So for me, it's very upsetting that to learn that this part of the bill is positioned to be taken away, to be erased and not be part of the law. It's very hard for me to see that after the big fight and all the work that we put to get these benefits and these protections for the workers.
Y ahora esto es vergonzoso escuchar o saber que el mismo Estado esté regresando para atrás en lugar de que vamos avanzando hacia adelante.
It's embarrassing to see that the state is stepping backward instead of stepping forwards with this kind of laws and protections for the workers.
Que ahora vengan y digan que quieren quitar esto después de que luchamos mucho para conseguir, y es para estar seguros nosotros como trabajadores esenciales.
And it's very upsetting to learn that this proposal is getting rid of this protection, because it really is embarrassing to see the state doing that because that gets less protection to the essential workers.
Y ahora no solo les exijo.
Ms. Dominguez, if you can please wrap, and then I will give it to Chair Pratt.
I'm sorry. I think Chair Noor, she was wrapping up. I'm going to interpret that into English right away. Señora Dominguez, por favor, usted podría terminar la última frase que dijo, por favor, para terminar, que solo tenemos dos minutos.
Sí, lo que estoy diciendo que ahora yo me siento indignada y me da mucho coraje que me quiten ahora este esfuerzo y esta lucha que yo hice en el pasado para beneficiar a personas que son las que nos quitan nuestro propio dinero.
So again, it's very upsetting to learn that this is a step backwards in the law, trying to get rid of this protection when we, the workers, and all the work that I did in the past to have this law approved and this benefits for the workers. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Dominguez. And again, thank you for the interpretation, Ms. Smith. Chair Pratt.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that we were being fair to all sides. You know, some of our testifiers, particularly those against wage theft, which is my provision, not only has the provisions been misconstrued, I think there's been inflammatory language. And also, I would like to see some fairness in the amount of testimony that's being given.
I appreciate that, Chair Pratt. And I think we'll, as we go into further discussions, maybe we can bring those provisions and have a more detailed discussion as we go through today. We have only a few testifiers left. If there are other testifiers who signed up, I'll be more than happy to accommodate them right now. So. The next person on the list is Ms. Heising. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Melissa Heising with the Minnesota AFL-CIO. You have two letters, one from Minnesota AFL-CIO that covers all of our priorities and concerns, and one from the Coalition to End Wage Theft. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition in opposition to the Senate wage theft provisions. When the law was enacted in 2019, many of you heard workers testify to the prevalence of wage theft in industries across the state, including construction, home health care, hospitality, janitorial, security, and temporary staffing agencies. You heard from workers who were not paid for all the hours they worked, for overtime or shift differentials, or not paid at all. You heard from workers who were required to work off the clock before and after their shifts and to work unpaid while in training. You heard about fudged timesheets, stolen tips, bounced paychecks, and employers who declared bankruptcy to avoid paying. You heard from workers whose employers threatened to report them to immigration or retaliated against them, including a man who had been fired from a temp agency that very day because he insisted on being paid his wages. This proposal undermines key elements of the 2019 law that ensure workers know in advance what they're going to be paid, and that penalties are adequate to deter violators. Employers could reduce wages after an employee has already worked, say from $15 an hour to 11, simply by changing the information in the written notice to match the pay stub. Temp workers could have their pay changed at any time without notice, and employers could effectively ignore the written notice requirements. Yesterday, you heard complaints about, quote, unlimited penalties. Under the law, penalties are already limited by the amount of wage theft that is committed. If an employer steals 10 days worth of wages, that is also the amount of the penalty. If they steal 30 days of wages, that's the penalty. Capping penalties allows the worst actors to factor penalties into their cost of doing business. Workers in industries plagued by wage theft have been on the front lines of this pandemic. They have been through enough already. We urge the committee not to adopt these provisions and not to go backwards on the progress we have made to end wage theft in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person I have is Mr. Gene Delgello. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Noor and Senator Pratt and member of the conference committee. Thank you for your leadership and for your consideration of my testimony. My name is Jean Galgalo, President and CEO at African Economic Development Solutions, AEDS, a nonprofit organization that serves African immigrants in Minnesota. We provide business development training, technical assistance, lending, financial literacy, homeownership education, workforce development, and credit placemaking program. I'm here to testify on Senate File 1098. Some of the highlights of our success in 2020 were we processed 4.8 million in grant and loan to 536 businesses and provide technical assistance to over 1,000 clients. Pandemic disproportionately impacted BIPOC business for two reasons. One, our small businesses lack capital before pandemic, and they are in retail, restaurant, and other industry that are most immediately affected by pandemic. Also, civil unrest disproportionately impacted BIPOC businesses in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. These businesses lost what they invested in for many years. BIPOC businesses or owners cannot afford to take more debt to their business, particularly businesses that were impacted by civil unrest are not in position to take more debt. Rather, grant and forgivable loans present a better alternative for our businesses. Invest on workforce development on businesses and organizations that employ, train, and retain members of BIPOC communities. Dedicated funding to nonprofit. Dedicated funding to nonprofit allow us to further equity and ensure we support most vulnerable of our community. Many businesses impacted by civil unrest are struggling to open their businesses. For example, Bali Ethiopia restaurant that was located at Syndicate and University Avenue in St. Paul was one of the businesses that was impacted by civil unrest. The business burned down to ashes and they lost everything. Because of their hard work and resilience, after 1 year of a struggle, they opened.
Mr. Gilgal, yes. if you can please wrap up your testimony, I appreciate it.
Yes, they opened new location at 1341 Pascal, St. Paul. This is one example. There are many in the process of reopening their business and need your support. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person on the list is Ms. Lee. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. You're muted, Ms. Lee.
Apologies. Good morning, Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and members of the committee. My name is Ruby Lee, and I'm president of CLUS, Comunidades Latinas Unidas en Servicio. I'm here to urge increased support for direct appropriations and support for CLUS expansion initiative in workforce and focus on reskilling, retraining, and increasing wages for low-income, unemployed, and underserved workers. Past direct appropriations enable CLUS to build a consistent delivery program without contractual gaps, funding uncertainties, or application delays. Direct investment from the state allows to tailor work readiness solutions that meet local and individual needs, including covering the cost of student tuition, uniforms, certification, etc. Direct appropriations also helped us expand workforce and wraparound support services in Wilmer, Austin, and other metro areas. Lack of direct appropriations will be detrimental to the successful momentum we built so far. CLUS is one of only two community-based Latino-led nonprofits serving Latinos in workforce initiatives. In the last year, we served over 5,000 individuals with employment needs alone. The demand for skills building and workforce development have increased, and we cannot go backwards, right as we started to come out of the pandemic. There is a place for the legislature to improve economic prosperity in the state by increasing wage disparities through direct investment in BIPOC-led community-based organizations that have the trust of their communities and proven track record of success. We urge you to consider a funding approach that includes direct appropriations and an increase for CLUS programs. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Ms. Lineman. Please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Lineman, and I'm testifying today as a citizen advocate on behalf of my son. My son and I, nearly two years ago, suffered severe carbon monoxide poisoning in a hotel. And so I'm testifying in support of the House file, which requires installation of carbon monoxide detectors in hotel rooms. I was shocked after being in a hotel for three nights, breathing in carbon gas and getting sicker and sicker each night with no carbon monoxide detector to alert us to the reason for our illness. When we eventually went to the emergency room and were diagnosed with carbon monoxide poisoning, I was absolutely shocked to learn that carbon monoxide detectors are not required. This is not a hypothetical danger to hotel workers, to first responders, and to hotel guests. This is a present danger that is unfortunately completely invisible and undetectable to members of the public and to members of the workforce. Literally, the only way to prevent these types of injuries is to require installation of detectors. And I think the misconception of the members of the public is that if you are lucky enough not to die of carbon monoxide poisoning, that you fully recover. But that is not the case for many people. Up to 50% of people who suffer carbon monoxide continue to have physical and emotional symptoms into the future because it is literally a brain injury. The carbon monoxide replaces oxygen in your body, in your brain. And so this provision is something that is urgent because there is a gap in Minnesota, a gap in protections to all of us. And so I will keep my remarks short, but I urge you to understand that this is a critical gap in our protections, and this is a gap that you can close to prevent death in Minnesota, to prevent injuries to people like me and to people like my son. So thank you for your time this morning, and I appreciate your consideration of this House file provision.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person I have on the list is Mr. Brace. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Noor, Chairman Pratt. My name is Tom Brace. I'm the Minnesota coordinator for the National Fire Sprinkler Association. I bring to you experience as the Washington State Fire Marshal for 10 years and the Minnesota State Fire Marshal for 16 years. We're delighted to see this bill being discussed at this point, the tragedy of five people who perished in the Cedar High fire in November of 2019 is a graphic reminder of the need for the technology that we're involved with, which is fire sprinklers. There's a recent excellent report by the current Minnesota State Fire Marshal that argued that had that building been sprinklered, the fire would have been contained, if you will, in the room of origin, where it started, and no one would have lost their lives. You saw an example of what happens. The irony is that if that structure was built today, there would be no question it would be sprinklered. But at the time when that facility was constructed, sprinklers were not a requirement. There are two people in addition that I wanted to talk about that are involved in these fires. Think, if you will, of the fire service on the 14th floor, carrying up all of the equipment so that they could fight the fire and render assistance. Obviously, first part is assistance and then to fight the fire. The residents, in many cases, have mobility problems. They may have inability to understand English. They have sometimes some age issues that require special consideration. I remember that the role of the fire service is to evacuate and then fight the fire. There has been opportunities before for this type of legislation. Minnesota actually tried it in 94 and 95. It was vetoed twice by then Governor Carlson, who was recently quoted in a Star Tribune article as saying that it may well have been an error to have vetoed it. And I want to recognize that publicly because we passionately believe that sprinklers do save lives and property. It's a technology that's been with us for over 100 years. Interestingly enough, it started out as protecting property and then found that there was significant life-saving capabilities, and now our renewed interest in efforts, particularly around saving lives, those of our seniors 60 and over and our children 10 and under, that die at a disproportionate rate. I would close with the fact that there are 12 years to bring about a completion of a sprinkler retrofit. You have 12 years to participate with a program through the State Fire Marshal Division, who will review your plans. And even if you can't get it done in 12 years, if you're making reasonable progress in the minds of the State Fire Marshal, then there's a possibility of an extension. I would also add that the State Fire Marshal's State Fire Marshal himself, Fire Marshal Smith, is a strong advocate of this effort, and we hope and pray that its time has come to save first lives, then property. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for your testimony. The next person is Mr. Farr.
Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, and members of this committee, good morning. My name is Mohamed Farah. I'm the Executive Director of Rising Impact, Kajok, a nationally recognized Somali youth development organization tailored towards the enriching the lives of Somali American and other East African youth across our state by utilizing the positive elements of education, mentoring, employment, and the arts. On behalf of the Somali Minnesota youth, I urge you to include in the final conference committee report an allocation of $4 million in funding over the next 2 years for a joint Youth Prize and Rising Impact Grant program, which provides economic development services for long-term economic self-sufficiency in Minnesota communities with concentrated East African populations. This is language and funding that was part of the amended version of the House File 1364. For the past eight years, our East African Youth at Work program has successfully created a two-way opportunity for youth on gain on the job experience and employer-created workplaces that are more culturally aware. The program has built job skills for East African youth across our state and has positioned them for employment success through internship, placements, career exploration, soft skill development, and mentorship. All participants who have successfully completed the program have received career assessments and exploration services, an individualized work plan, and paid internship or job placements. Hundreds of youth have completed the program so far, and they have sought various careers in information technology, the public health sector, law and security, accounting, business management, marketing, business administration, public services, and social work and case management. Providing hands-on training has been an essential and vital part of the program as a way to improve productivity and build capacity, knowledge and skills needed in various industries. Examples of these trainings have included CNA or certified nursing, Java coding, web design, graphic design, digital marketing, database administration, and AWS training coding. The need for this funding and the need for this bill is obvious and vital. As you know, the Minnesota Somali community has the highest level of economic and education disparities among all communities of color in our state. With the support of this committee, we can continue to do some great work throughout Minnesota. This committee and the state of Minnesota have partners like Youth Prize and Rising Impact, who have been on the ground for many years. This committee understands the racial inequalities that exist in Minnesota, and I cannot stress enough about the work that must continue and that must be done for our community, for our communities of color across Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Pratt, and the committee members for your time and consideration.
The next person we have, thank you, Mr. Farr. The next person we have is Mr. Colas. Please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Pratt, committee members. I'm Chad Coolis, Executive Director of the Midway Chamber of Commerce. We're located in the Midway neighborhood in St. Paul, at the corner of Snelling and University, have around 350 members, mostly our small businesses and nonprofits, and have been around since 1919. This past year, the Midway Chamber, along with the St. Paul Area Chamber and the St. Paul Downtown Alliance, created the We Love Midway, We Love St. Paul Fund to help support all of those businesses that were impacted by civil unrest. To date, we've been able to contribute over $950,000 to over 80 grantees. These were grants, not loans, designed to help those in need again, once again, because of civil unrest. We've talked to many businesses over the past year and learned a little bit more about their stories and have heard from so many of them that they cannot take on more loans this year. Businesses, especially those affected by civil unrest, are in a position to take on more debt they can't pay for. Rather, grants and forgivable loans present a better alternative, including for our many BIPOC businesses. In uncertain times, there is an even greater need to support BIPOC communities, especially with workforce development funding that can help employ, train, and retain people. Due to large inequalities, there's an argument to make more policy changes specifically aimed at the most disadvantaged communities. Along with our small business community, we have many nonprofits near the Capitol and along University Avenue. Nonprofits take care of large swaths of our community that government are not necessarily able to reach. They operate to inform, protect, and provide resources for our communities that have historically not been provided the opportunity to be present at the table. Dedicated funding to nonprofits allows us to further equity and ensure that we support the most vulnerable. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Mr. Swanson Klatt. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Noor, Chairman Pratt, and members of the committee. My name is Daniel Swenson-Klatt. I own and operate Butter Bakery Cafe in South Minneapolis. And for the past 15 years, we've been working to provide a healthy workplace. So I speak in favor today of adding paid, earned, sick and safe time or paid medical leave to your final budget proposal. I speak for small businesses across our state to say that we do value our employees. We succeed when our communities are healthy and when all are welcome and can thrive. And I believe small businesses can and should lead the state to remove racial inequities, help it become one Minnesota. As a business owner, I commit to doing this by treating all of my workers fairly, to pay a living wage, and support them to meet their needs. But I shouldn't be expected to do this out on my own. I need a level playing field. 6 years ago, Minneapolis debated adding an earned sick and safe time ordinance, and I created that proposal in my own business for my own 21 employees, because if I was going to encourage others, I needed to live that change myself. I knew I could do better. And so I found that it was an investment that paid off. The adoption of the proposal wasn't burdensome, it wasn't onerous, it wasn't costly. Instead, it provided my staff with security, with a sense of investment in my business. It reduced the costly staff turnover. It reduced all those costs of hiring and empty shifts. We grew as a business. And over the years, that 2 to 3% increase in payroll was a return far greater. Now, during this past year, during the pandemic, those needs were even greater. But with a generous, supportive paid leave time off policy that we created and you as a legislator supported, we were able to keep our staff. Of the 12 who were with me when the shutdowns began at the end of the year, the 12 were still with me. That gets me a spot I can grow from. Now, we need this to continue. The pandemic may be over shortly, but leave time and sick time does not end. So please, you're going to hear from folks who say, I don't want to deal with mandates. I don't want to deal with change. But this is what we need. It's the right thing to do. And fortunately, the right thing to do is profitable. So let's please put paid leave time into your budget proposal in the end. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The last person on the list I have is Mr. Adam Dunick. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Adam Dunick. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. I'm here today on behalf of our 12,000 members in Minnesota. Today, I want to speak on the safe and skilled workforce provision, the OSHA citation language, and on wage theft. I want to begin by adding our support for the safe and skilled workforce bill that other trades have testified on. The jobs in the refineries are incredibly important and high risk, and we support having the most skilled, safest workers performing that work. When it comes to safety, we believe that OSHA citations ought to also be made public, as they are in nearly every state in the country and every state we are surrounded by. We applaud the department for putting the bill forward, and we believe it is a modest yet meaningful policy change. We had a productive meeting with Senator Rarick about this provision and stand ready to continue to work on this portion of the bill. We worked in a collaborative and bipartisan way to pass a wage theft bill a couple years ago. A number of you were involved in that effort. It was a necessary and crucial first step in trying to deter wage theft, work comp fraud, and other pernicious labor violations that accompany the underground construction economy. The thinking when we passed the bill was that if we could hold the worst cheaters accountable, responsible employers would be rewarded. There are many business owners that we've engaged in our union with this labor management partnership that hold the same belief, and they want to see the wage theft law be successful and continue to be successful. The bipartisan nature of the bill is the key to its success now and in the future. And this is why we've been working with Chair Pratt on some language around including collective bargaining agreements in the, as a pre-employment notification. However, there is one section of the bill that we are opposed to quite strongly, and that's the language that attempts to cap the penalties at 15 days. We believe that this change would not help to deter the worst cheating employers. In the construction industry, it is common for the total amount of dollars of wage theft to add up to tens of thousands and even at times hundreds of thousands of dollars over a construction season. Shockingly large sums of money. Merit Drywall is a recent example of this, as they were charged with running a fraudulent scheme that exploited the insurance company out of more than $300,000 in workers' compensation insurance. And we have another instance that we've worked recently to uncover where workers are owed six-figure sums by their labor brokers. These amounts of money are stolen over months, and so to cap the penalties would not serve those exploited workers who should never be in a position to have to fight for those back wages. The penalties serve as a much-needed deterrent. I want to thank Chair Neuer, Chair Eklund, Chair Pratt, and Chair Rarick, and the rest of the conference committee for your work on this bill, and we stand ready to continue to work on these issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and also to everyone who came to testify today. We will be moving to the second portion of the agenda today, so that will be the adoption of same and similar provisions. With that, I just wanted to turn over to the nonpartisan staff, Ms. Charlene, to start us with some of the provisions, and we'll be adopting one by one as we go forward.
Thank you, Chair and members. I'll be starting with economic development policy. The provision on page R2, Senate sections 3 through 5. The staff recommendation is to accept the Senate language. They are similar provisions that put a 10-year expiration date on development restrictions for Greater Minnesota business development public infrastructure grants and allow up to 15% of a development to be used for a purpose outside the program guidelines, all retroactively.
Thank you, Ms. Charlene. Representative Bragg, did you want to move adoption of that provision?
I move.
Representative Buck moves the adoption of Senate Section 3 through 5 on the beginning on page R2 of the side-by-side in the Economic Development section for Senate File 1098. Any discussions? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? See none. The provision is adopted. Ms. Charlene.
The next provision is similar language in both bills that changes the purpose of the fiscal year 2018 appropriation from an effluent pipe to a wastewater infrastructure in Rosemont and keeps funds available until fiscal year 25. Staff recommends adoption of the Senate language in Senate Section 6 on page R22.
Senator Hulls, do you move the adoption of that provision?
So moved, Chair Norris.
Thank you. Senator Housing moves adoption of Senate Section 6 on the beginning on page R22 of the side-by-side in Economic Development section for Senate File 1098. Any discussion? See none.
Mr. Chairman, I have my hand.
Yes. Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I raised this concern in committee, and I'll just raise it once again. I am going to support this motion. However, when these monies were set aside initially, it was a completely different project than it is currently. And now it's going towards wastewater infrastructure. So I just simply raised the concern, and I wanted to raise it again. I don't know if Deed wants to get into the wastewater infrastructure projects or not. However, once again, I just wanted to raise the concern. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much, Lead Hamilton, for that. And I also wanted to note that we do have Commissioner Grove and Commissioner Robertson with us today if we have any questions in regard to any of this section. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. Charlene.
The next item is a similar provision in both bills that modifies the fiscal year 2020 appropriation for Duluth Paper Mill. While the House provision also does some additional item that is not being discussed at this time. Staff recommends adopting the identical language from the Senate provision about the Duluth Paper Mill.
Representative Olson, do you move the adoption of this provision?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson moved. Yes.
Sorry, I just wanted to make note in the list of motions I sent out to the members and staff, it says page R33. It's actually page R31. Staff has note of that. I just wanted to make sure that people were following the motion. The correct one would be page R31, not R33 for this particular motion, just so we know.
Thank you so much, Mr. Reese. So Representative Olson moves adoption of Senate Section 7 beginning on R31 of the side-by-side in the Economic Development section for the Senate File 1098. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. Jolene.
The next item is identical language in both bills that keeps the fiscal year 2020 appropriation for workers' compensation system upgrades available until 2023. And it begins on page R39, section 8 in both bills, though in House Article 7.
Senator Eakin, do you move the adoption of this provision?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Eakin moves the adoption of House Section 8 on page R39 of the side-by-side in the Economic Development section for the Senate File 1098. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. Charlene.
The final provision in the economic development section is identical language in both bills on page R48 that make a one-time exception to how local governments can spend repayments from MIF loans. In exchange for transferring 20% of the uncommitted funds to the state general fund, the local government can spend the remainder for any lawful purpose.
Lead Hamilton, do you move the adoption for this provision?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton moves the adoption of House Section 36 on page R48 of the side-by-side in the Economic Development section for the Senate File 1098. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. To the next section, Ms. Sholey.
I'd actually like to pass it to Ms. Doyle Fontaine to do the labor and industry policy items. Thank you.
Ms. Fontaine.
Good morning, Carlin Doyle Fontaine, and I will do the labor and industry provisions. The first section is the same on both sides. It's on page R1. This section would make child labor data that's collected as part of an OSHA investigation, it would make it private. And the staff recommends the Senate just adopt the Senate language, just either they're the same, but just adopt the Senate language.
Chair Rarick, do you move the adoption of this provision?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rarick moves the adoption of the Senate Section 1 on page R1 of the side-by-side in the labor and industry section of the Senate File 1098. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. Fontaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next section is on page R2. This would conform to federal apprenticeship law, and the staff recommends the House section 5 on page R2.
Chair Eklund, do you move the adoption of this provision?
That's my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eklund moves adoption of House Section 5 on page R2 of the side-by-side in the labor industry for Senate File 1098. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. Fontaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next section is on page R11. This section would creates a new section of law that makes child labor data that is collected by the Department of Labor and Industry private. And the staff recommends the Senate Section 6 on R11 be adopted.
Senator Durheim, do you move the adoption of this provision?
So moved, Chair Nor.
Senator Durheim moves the adoption of the Senate Section 6 on page R11 of the side-by-side in the labor and industry section for Senate File 1098. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. Fontaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then the final section in a labor and industry article is on page R17. This would add two additional members to the Construction Codes Advisory Council, one from the energy conservation industry and the other with expertise in building accessibility. This staff recommends Senate section be adopted, section 8 on page R17.
Chair Pratt, do you move the adoption of this section?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt moves adoption of Senate section 8 on page R17 of the side-by-side in the labor and industry section for Senate File 1098. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. The next section, unemployment insurance. Ms. Fontaine.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Actually, Marta James will take this next.
Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I'm Marta James from House Research. Turning to the unemployment insurance policy provisions on R7, there is a same provision for shared work program purposes, decreasing the timeline from 1 year to 3 months. These are the same, and the staff recommend the House provision.
Representative Buck, do you move the adoption of Senate of this provision?
That's so moved, Chair Noor.
Representative Buck moves the adoption of Senate Section 5 on page R7 of the side-by-side in the unemployment insurance section for Senate File 1098. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. James.
Next on R8, there is a similar provision regarding the temporary and continued suspension of the 5-week business owner benefit limitation. There are technical differences, and staff recommends that the House language be used. That is House Section 9.
Senator Hauser, do you move the adoption of this section? Senator Housley, you're muted.
I don't know how that happened. So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Senator Housley moves adoption of the House Section 9 on page R8 of the side-by-side in the unemployment insurance section of Senate File 1098. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Ms. James.
Finally, Mr. Chair, numbers on R8. There's a similar provision for a leave of absence due to COVID-19 and how that's treated for UI purposes. Again, there are technical differences in the language and the staff recommends that House language be used. That is House Section 10.
Representative Olson, do you move the adoption of this section?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson moves the adoption of House Section 10 on page R8 of the side-by-side in the Unemployment Insurance section for Senate File 1098. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the provision is adopted. Thank you to the nonpartisan staff and everyone who really helped in the adoption of these sections. Any discussions, any further discussions, members and senators? And we also have the Commissioner for Deed and Commissioner for DLI.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Lead Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's appropriate, but after, and if not, just let me know. But I had a question to one of the last testifiers, and maybe staff can help me with this. It was Ms. Mercado's testimony, where she was unemployed because of COVID for over a month. I was wondering if she was eligible for unemployment insurance and the supplemental unemployment insurance. So if you don't have that information now, if someone in the same scenario would be eligible for that, if staff or somebody could just get back to me with that information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Lead Hamilton. If anyone wanted to respond to that, otherwise we will be moving to the other sections. Lead Hamilton, we'll get you that information as we get going with this process. So thank you so much for the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now we move into the provisions that we did not go through. So Ms. James, if you can walk us through the first item on the paid family medical leave. I'm assuming that's correct.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I am going to go through today the House-only articles in the bill. I'm going to start with the paid family and medical leave articles, which are Articles 4 and 5. These came from House File 1200, introduced by Representative Richardson. And I'm going to walk through it section by section. There's a lot of information here, so I'm going to keep it high level, but of course, I'm happy to answer any questions at the end. So, and then just to clarify too, what was sent out, each of the House-only articles are their separate, are in separate PDFs, so they all are going to start on page one. I also have the page numbers for the larger first unofficial engrossment of Senate File 1098. So on page one or page 75 of the first unofficial engrossment, starting with section one. So this is a data provision and clarifies that paid family and medical leave data is private and non-public. Section two is regarding compliance orders. The Department of Labor and Industry is going to have enforcement and compliance over authority over the employment protections and the employee chargeback provisions in the program, and I'm going to discuss those more shortly. Section three is related to wage theft and the statement of earnings that needs to be provided to employees, the premiums that are paid by employers, as well as the employee chargebacks need to be included. Section four, use of data. This clarifies that the Department of Employment Economic Development, DEED, can use unemployment insurance data for the purpose of administering paid family medical leave. And I just want to clarify too, we'll hear throughout this summary that a lot of the concepts, structure, processes of the family medical leave program do borrow from DEED, or excuse me, from the unemployment insurance system and model that. So to the extent that there's unemployment insurance data that can be used for the program, that is allowed. Section five contains many definitions. Again, some of these definitions or a lot of them come from the unemployment statute. And just to clarify upfront, the definitions for employer and employee are very broad and largely include all employers except and for independent contractors or self-employed individuals who can opt in. Section six creates the actual program itself. It's going to be a new program or would be a new program administered by DEED. It creates a new division in DEED to administer the program. It also creates a new account, the Family and Medical Benefit Insurance account. This is similar to the UI Trust Fund, and that's where all the premiums will be paid into or will go into and will then be used to pay out benefits. Section 7, Payment of Benefits. This provides applicant requirements, and similar to UI, the benefits are paid out of that account I just mentioned from state funds as opposed to an employer paying an individual employee. There's several requirements that are listed in that section. Section 8 contains the meat of what the benefits would look like and the benefit account. So like UI, an applicant would need to establish a benefit account. They would have to meet the requirements for that. That largely means having sufficient wage credits, which for 2021 would be $3,100 in the last four quarters. So the provisions would provide up to 12 weeks of family leave and up to 12 weeks of medical leave each year, so up to 24 weeks total, and that would be for a qualifying event of 7 days. Most of these leaves, or all of them, I believe, would require medical certification. And then the benefits themselves pay for a portion of the weekly salary up to a max, which for 2021 is $1,144. Benefits can also be prorated. Turning then to Section 9, like unemployment, an applicant will need to do a continued request for benefits each week showing that they are continuing to be eligible. Section 10 contains those eligibility requirements. And I won't go into all of them in detail, but again, they would need to file that continued request, have sufficient wage credits, get that certification from a healthcare provider. So that would be for something like their own serious health condition or pregnancy for medical leave, or a family member, a serious health condition or other reasons. Section 11, when an applicant applies to deed, they must be notified of their eligibility within 2 weeks, and that will go to both employee and employer. There is an appeals process for any determination. That's going to go before a benefit judge and ultimately can be appealed up to the Court of Appeals. So this leave in Section 13 would start to apply to an employee 90 days after they start working. Whenever feasible or foreseeable, an employee does need to provide notice to their employer. And there are intermittent leave options. Again, you would have to meet that 7-day qualifying event timeline, but may be allowed to leave intermittently. Section 14 contains those employment protections. Like I mentioned, Department of Labor Industry has enforcement authority over this section. There's several of those, but I'll just highlight a couple. Those include things that, like, you cannot lose your other benefits while you're on leave or face retaliation for taking a leave, and you must return to the same or similar position when you come back. There's also a private cause of action established for violations. Section 15 allows employers to substitute their own private plan. So if an employer has a family leave provision or a medical leave provision or both, they are allowed to substitute their own plan if it provides the same or better benefits. So if they substitute that plan, then they would pay a reduced or no premium, but there is a fee for the actual plan approval. Section 16, like I mentioned, this bill would not cover self-employed or independent contractors. They can choose or elect coverage and then pay the premium, but otherwise would not be included. Section 17 requires employers to submit wage reports. This is similar to the unemployment system. Again, this is the wages are going to be what the premiums are based on. Section 18, employer premium accounts. Again, like UI, employers will have a premium account where they submit their payments for the program. Section 19 contains the details of how premiums are going to be paid and assessed. And premiums will start January 1st, 2023. There's an initial formula for the first 2 years, and then starting January 1st, 2026, there will be a different calculation. I'll just point out that the max amount of wages that can be assessed a premium are $142,800 for 2021. And if someone was earning that maximum amount paying a full 0.6% premium for both programs or both leave, family, and medical benefits, that would be about $856 a year. Like I mentioned, employers can charge back 50% of the premium to employees. So if under that scenario, each employer and employee would be paying about $428 a year, which averages out to $35 a month. So that's the absolute most if you were earning up to $142,000 in taxable wages. Arguably, a lot of people will be lower than that. Section 20 talks about federal taxes. If the IRS determines that these benefits are taxable, they will be withheld and applicants and asked deed to do that. Section 21 again talks about the collection of premiums and that deed will determine those amounts and allows for adjustments and things like that. Section 22, if an applicant has outstanding child support obligations, that must be deducted from paid family medical leave benefits, and deed would be doing that as well. Section 23 allows deed to compromise a premium or reimbursement when it's in the state's best interests, and there's some parameters around that. Sections 24 and 25 talk about the penalties and costs for employees and employers Section 24 is the administrative cost. So that actually says how much of the revenue that deed can use to administer the program. As I mentioned, the premiums are going to start being collected, and up to 7% of that amount can be used to administer the program. And then Section 25, similarly, there's a percentage of those revenues that can be used for outreach and education, as well as grants to community groups. Section 26 covers benefit overpayments. Again, this is very similar to how it is set up in the UI statute. And there are penalties and interests that would be applied for an applicant who receives an overpayment that eventually gets canceled after about 6 to 10 years, depending on the circumstances. Now the administrative penalties I mentioned, sections 27 and 28. So for an employee or employer who intentionally misrepresents or omits information, there are some penalties assessed for that. Section 29 contains records and audits and requires that certain records be kept for a certain time period. It also allows deed to audit and investigate those things. Section 30, like I mentioned, there's going to be a process to appeal through a benefits judge. And so this allows the benefits judge to administer oaths or issue subpoenas, different acts that are needed to administer the Family Medical Leave Act. Section 31, if there are amounts that are owed under the bill, those can be treated as a lien or levy on property or set off. Section 32 allows for conciliation services through the Department of Labor and Industry to settle disputes regarding the Family and Medical Leave Program. Section 33 requires an annual report to the legislature, both on the operation and finance of the program and several other items. Those are just an overview. Section 34 are the notice requirements. So employers need to notify employees of their rights under the bill and independent contractors as well. Section 35 clarifies the relationship to other leaves. So you may be aware there are other types of unpaid leaves available, family medical leave and pregnancy and parenting accommodations under Chapter 181 in Minnesota. Those are unpaid leaves, but to the extent that they are used for the same purpose, those would run concurrently with this leave. Section 36 is standard, including that if any provision is inconsistent with federal law, the rest remains in full force. And Section 37 provides grants to businesses with 50 or fewer employees. So businesses with 50 or fewer employees that have to hire someone temporarily or have wage-related costs due to giving leave to their employees could qualify for those grants. The last section are the effective dates for the bill, and I'll just generally kind of go over those. Like I mentioned, the premium-related sections are going to start January 1st, 2023, so that's when the actual payment of premiums would start. The benefits themselves and any kind of benefit account-related sections would not begin until January 1st, 2024, so a year later. And then some of the more general provisions to get the program up and running would commence on July 1st, 2021. So that is the substance of the paid family medical leave in Article 4. I'll move then to Article 5, which is how family and medical benefits are treated as earnings. So this article, and this is, again, on the PDF, it's on page 64. And the unofficial engrossment, it would start on page 138 at line 10. So these provisions are largely related to Department of Human Services programs, and they clarify in sections 1, 2, and 3 that parents are exempt from certain provisions for NFIP participation related to employment services and diversionary work programs if they're receiving the family and medical leave benefits. And then for the purposes of NFIP, general assistance, housing support, and other DHS programs, any family medical leave benefits received are treated as earned income. Those specific provisions are going to go into, would go into effect January 1st, 2024. All right, so that is Articles 4 and 5, and I'm happy to move on to the next article, Mr. Chair, if you would like.
Thank you so much. I'm assuming the next article is the emergency rehire retention, which will be picked up by Chair Eklund. So any discussions, members, in regards to the paid family medical leave? I'll begin. I just wanted to make sure that I understood the 12 weeks. It's not 24 weeks, as many people have already stated. It's only 12 weeks, and it runs concurrent with any other paid or unpaid leave. Is that correct, Ms. James?
Mr. Chair and members, it's up to 12 weeks for family leave and then also up to 12 weeks for medical leave. So someone would have to qualify for both of those types of leave in 1 year, but could potentially be up to 24 weeks. And yes, it would run concurrently with other leaves.
Thank you for your clarification on that. Any discussions? We do have Ms. Deb Fitzpatrick in case of any questions, and we also have the Commissioner for Deed for any questions in regard to this. Seeing none, we will be moving to Chair Eklund so that we can have the discussions on the labor and industry sections of the bill. Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I haven't moved and I lost my agenda. So, Ms. James, if you want to proceed with the next article, that would be fine.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to go in order of the bill, if that's all right. The next article in order was House Article 9 and 10 for the Earned Sick and Safe Time provisions. Those came from House File 7, which was introduced by Representative Olson. So in your PDF, starting on page 1 or in the bigger House bill, it starts on page 176 at line 16. Section 1 is a conforming change. Section 2 provides the definitions for the bill. And so defines employee as anyone who has worked at least 80 hours in a year for an employer, but doesn't include an independent contractor. Section 3 provides the provisions for the earned sick and safe time. So it requires that employees would accrue 1 hour of paid earned sick and safe time for every 30 hours worked. They could earn up to 48 hours per year. So they would start to accrue at when they begin employment, but they would be able to use it until 90 days after employment. They would be paid their full salary on this leave, and then would be allowed to carry over up to 80 hours a year. Section 4 contains the use of the earned sick and safe time. So when an employee would be allowed to take this sick leave. And I think generally it's helpful to think about the earned sick and safe time is more of a traditional sick leave, paid sick leave provision, whereas the family and medical leave, like I mentioned, is for a longer term serious illness or condition. So there isn't the 7-day requirement in this bill. So this is for an employee's own illness or family member's illness. It also covers things like domestic abuse, assault, stalking, if there's a closure of a daycare or workplace due to weather, and those types of things. Again, Section 4 kind of contains all the requirements for the use of earned sick and safe time. There are a few, so I won't go through all of them. But again, if this leave is if the need for the leave is foreseeable, an employee needs to let their employer know. An employer can require documentation after 3 days. Similarly, an employee cannot be retaliated against for taking this leave. They would be entitled to the same position and benefits when they returned, and they wouldn't be required to find a replacement. There's also some record keeping provisions related to earned sick and safe time. In Section 5, nothing prevents an employer or a collective bargaining agreement from providing the same or more or better benefits. If you have an existing policy that meets or exceeds these requirements, that could continue. And then there's an opt-out provision for construction workers who are paid prevailing wage or a registered apprenticeship agreement rate. The earned sick and safe time leave sick time is not payable upon separation. So basically it's a use it or lose it. And again, you can carry over 80 hours a year. And then Section 6 is a repealer related to existing use of or required use of sick leave. And for this Article 9, it would be effective 180 days after enactment. Article 10 then contains the enforcement provisions for earned sick and safe time. And so that starts on page 10 of the PDF or 185 of the unofficial engrossment, line 12. So Section 1 increases the penalty amounts. So the Department of Labor Industry can require records for various things. This would increase the penalty from $1,000 to $10,000, up to $10,000. Section 2, again, gives the Department of Labor Industry compliance over authority over the earned sick and safe time provisions. They have this authority for a lot of other labor provisions, and this would allow them to issue compliance orders with these provisions. Section 3 then is tied to employer liability for those compliance requirements, like I said, and again, it would increase the penalty that DALI could assess from $1,000 to $10,000, up to $10,000 for violations. Section 4, it contains earned sick and safe time enforcement information as well, and provides for rulemaking by the Department of Labor and Industry. It also provides for a private cause of action for potential violations and includes grants to community organizations for outreach and education. It also requires an annual report to the legislature. on earned sick and safe time. So that is very briefly House Articles 9 and 10 for the earned sick and safe time provisions. And I can move to the next article if you would like, Mr. Chair.
Ms. James, we'll hold up for a minute, see if there's any comments or questions on this article. Any members' questions or comments? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just think it's worth noting, you know, in the House side, obviously, we're carrying a number of provisions that didn't have a chance to be heard in the Senate. So some of the discussion we'd often have after hearing earned sick and safe time and paid family leave is, you know, the similarity of it. So I think Ms. James noted one part, but it's worth noting that, and I think we've heard from the testifiers today too, is that, you know, all of these provisions work to protect workers in a variety of ways, but they all serve a very different function, and that earned sick and safe time is an earned benefit that, you know, is different from what we heard around paid family leave. And just to note, as we bring these provisions forward, they all serve workers, but they serve it for different purposes, as we heard from the testifiers, and this being more temporary and an earned benefit, and just worth noting kind of in the scheme of things as we kind of go through some really big things very quickly. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would, you know, just like to remind the committee that there were a number of provisions in the Senate bill that also weren't heard in the House. So we've got that going kind of consistency between the two bodies, provisions that have also generated significant support, as we heard in testimony. And so I just wanted to make sure that we balanced out Representative Olson's comments.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. Any other member questions or comments? I'll just comment on one. I retired from a fine company, provided lots of good benefits and pension and all that kind of stuff. The one thing they didn't have was paid earned sick and safe time. I applaud the bill for having the provision in there. If a company offers it, that this doesn't take that place. But in 29 years, I called in. I think I sat on House floor three times. I've thought back on that a little more. It was probably six times in 29 years. I can guarantee as 29 years of being a shift worker, there was probably more than the times than that that I was ill and brought in whatever I was carrying, or coworkers doing the same type of things. So I'm hoping we can get some traction on these bills. I appreciate everybody's patience listening into them, and let's see how the process moves as we go forward. Please proceed, Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So turning then to House Article 11, this is the Emergency Rehire and Retention Law or Bill. This was introduced under House File 39 by Representative Carlson. So this starts on page 1 of your PDF or on page 188 of the Unofficial Engrossment, line 17. The first section provides definitions. At a very high level, I think enterprise is defined generally as hospitality industry employers. And so this would apply to businesses like hotels, airports, event centers, the facilities that are attached to them, things like maintenance, ticketing, check-in, food and beverage, and then as well as maintenance and security. Section 2 provides the emergency rehire and retention of laid off employees provisions. So there's kind of two parts. There's the rehire and retention during a declared emergency, and then there's also the successor employee retention, and I'll just go over those very briefly. So during a declared emergency, an employee who is laid off would have to, when they're bringing employees back, would get the first option to come back and be offered positions. They would have to be qualified for those positions, and this would be based on a preference system of qualifications and seniority. And then they would have to have been employed for more than 6 months after January 31st, 2020. So those are the rehire and retention. And then there's also the successor employer retention provisions. And this is with an ownership change. So if a new employer takes over, And for the first 6 months after that transition, they must offer openings to existing employees of the business or employer or former employer, and then allow them to work for at least 90 days before they would make any permanent decisions. And to qualify for that, an employee would have had to work for the former employer at least 1 month or more. An employer cannot take adverse action for any employees exercising these rights. And again, there's nothing that prevents an employer or a collective bargaining agreement from providing more or better benefits than what are provided in the bill. Section 3 contains the enforcement and compliance provisions. The Department of Labor and Industry would have enforcement authority as, and they would be able to issue a compliance order, reinstatement or back pay or any of those types of things. And again, there's a private cause of actions for potential violations. Local law is not limited from providing better provisions. The bill is referred to, or this article, I should say, is referred to as the Emergency Rehire and Retention Law. And this would be effective the day following enactment until December 31st, 2022. So that is the emergency rehire and retention provisions from House Article 11.
Any member questions? Thank you, Ms. James. Any member questions on this or comments on this bill or article? Representative Berg.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. I just want to speak up in support of this provision. This is my world as an airline employee and adjacent then to the hotel and hospitality industry. I think this is critical in protecting workers that have worked this job for a number of years. They're loyal, they love their job, they're productive, right? And then something like this happens and employers take advantage of this situation to bring in new workers at lower wages. I think it's important that we provide this protection for workers. And also in some of the testimony that we've heard today that ties into when you treat your employees well, you as a business owner prosper because those employees are loyal. You don't have to pay for the cost of attrition and hiring new people and the entire process. This just streamlines both for the employer and the workers. So I just think this is a really critical component of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Any other comments or questions? Please proceed, Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So next, I will go over the essential workers' emergency leave provisions. This is House Article 12, originally from House File 41, introduced by Representative Frazier. Page 1 of your PDF or page 196, line 4 of the unofficial engrossment. Again, the essential workers' emergency leave portion starts with definitions. I'll point out the definition of who is an essential worker. So that's someone who has worked for an employer 1 day or more. And this would apply to someone, to employees or workers, I should say, such as emergency responders, healthcare providers, hospital workers, nursing home and assisted living workers, public school employees, airport service workers, childcare, hotel, food, retail workers, and maintenance, security, and manufacturing workers. So that's how the bill is defining essential workers. So these are subdivisions, I should say. So this is all Section 1, but I'll go over the individual subdivisions. So Subdivision 1 was the definitions. Subdivision 2 then provides the meat if the emergency paid sick leave provisions. So this would provide up to 160 hours of emergency sick leave, and that's 80 hours through March 31st, 2021, and another 80 hours through September 30th, 2021. So the emergency paid sick leave could be used for workers unable to work or telework for a COVID-19 related reason, and they could not be receiving other benefits like workers' compensation, unemployment, or other state or federal benefits. Some of the reasons that someone could take this leave would be if they are under quarantine or self-quarantine, or they're caring for someone subject to quarantine while they're waiting for a diagnosis for COVID, for a COVID vaccine, or recovering from a COVID vaccine, or a school or daycare closure. Those are some of the reasons. Like I said, it would an employee could receive up to 80 hours through March 31st, 2021, and then an additional 80 hours through September 30th, 2021. That's in Subdivision 3. And that's for a full-time worker. So there, the bill does, or this article does provide provisions for how part-time or variable hour workers would be treated. It would also allow for intermittent use, and again, that reasonable notice whenever possible. And this leave would expire on September 30th of 2021 or 30 days after the peacetime emergency ends. So this is a temporary provision. In terms of the amount of compensation, that's subdivision 4. So an employee could receive their full compensation at their regular rate with a cap of $511 per day, or just over $10,000 in total. And again, there would be no payout upon separation. You use it or lose it, and there would be no carryover for this time. Subdivision 5 discusses relationship to other leave. So this emergency sick leave is an addition to any paid time off that the employer provides. So an employee would not be required to use their existing PTO first. They would have to, they would use this leave first. The one caveat on that is if an employer has already provided additional leave during the COVID-19 pandemic, that was the same or better, meaning that the employee received their full pay or better, then they are not under further obligation. They would not need to provide additional time. But for example, if someone provided, 2 weeks of time at 2/3 pay or less than full amount, then they would need to top that off and make them whole up to those caps that I mentioned. Subdivision 6 provides a nursing home reimbursement requirement. So for nursing homes that are providing this benefit or paying for this benefit for their workers, they could seek reimbursement for those costs through the Department of Human Services Natural Disaster Assistance, and that's an existing provision. Subdivision 7 contains the requirements and enforcement. The Department of Labor and Industry would have the ability to enforce and investigate any potential violations, and again, issue that compliance order. And there's a provision for a $1,000 fine for willful violations. Again, an employee could not face an adverse action or be treated differently if they do take this leave. The effective date for this bill, I want to clarify that. So it is retroactive to March 13th, 2020 for workers who are employed right now or when the bill takes effect. So if a worker was employed on or after March 13th and continues to be employed when or if this would go into effect, they would qualify retroactively. If they are no longer employed, there is no obligation to provide these benefits to former workers. And then for anyone hired after this would take effect, that would not be retroactive for them. And like I mentioned, this would expire September 30th, 2021, or 30 days after the peacetime emergency ends. And those are the provisions for the Essential Workers Emergency Leave article.
Thank you, Ms. James. Any comments or questions on this article? I'll just comment that I think that our healthcare workers have been heroic in what they've done in this pandemic, and I'm thankful that Representative Frazier brought this forward. It's a good temporary fix to what they've been through in this past year and a half, and I'm hopeful that we'll move forward and be able to provide them some relief for their work. Thank you. Please proceed, Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The final House-only article is Article 13, the Safe Workplaces for Meat and Poultry Processing Workers. This comes from House File 800, introduced by Representative Wolgamott. Page 1 of the PDF, or starting on page 202 of the unofficial engrossment at line 5. Section 1 of the bill provides the title, that's the Safe Workplace for Meat and Poultry Processing Workers Act. Section 2 provides definitions used in the article. I'll just point out who is a meat processing worker. A meat processing worker is someone who's actually directly working with the raw meat packing products in the operation, and that would include an independent contractor or staffing agency worker. Section 3 creates a workers' rights coordinator that would be appointed by the Department of Labor and Industry Commissioner, and that workers' rights coordinator would enforce, inspect, and review safety issues at meat packing operations and then recommend improvements. There would also be an annual report that would need to be provided to the governor and legislature. Section 4 is the refusal to work under dangerous conditions. So this would allow a meat processing worker to refuse to work in good faith for unsafe conditions if they had reported the conditions and the employer had not corrected it, and they would continue to receive pay while they were out for that basis, and they would could not face retaliation for refusing to work in good faith. Section 5 provides enforcement and compliance for the article, and this would be shared by a few entities. So the worker rights coordinator that I mentioned would have an administrative enforcement, the attorney general, state and county attorneys, and then the Department of Labor and Industry would also have enforcement provision or enforcement authority. Again, they would employees could bring a private civil cause of action for potential violations. That would include a whistleblower claim. A whistleblower claim is an employee reports a health or safety concern, and then shortly thereafter is treated differently in the terms and conditions of their employment. Section 6 prohibits retaliation against employers for those whistleblower claims or whistleblower protections. So if an employee reports unsafe conditions, they could not be treated differently in their work terms and conditions as a result. It also creates a presumption of retaliation if there is an adverse work action taken within 90 days of reporting. So that would include things like being fired, being moved to a different lesser position, reduced benefits, and those types of things. There are fines available for whistleblower claims, as well as attorney fees, lost pay, and up to 30 times the damage amounts for a successful whistleblower claim. Section 7 contains several safety requirements for meat packing operations and protections for workers. There's a lot in this section, so I won't go over everything. I will just highlight a couple of the different provisions. So this would require meat processing operations to create a safe worker program, and that program and committee would be responsible for identifying hazards and looking for improvements in the operation. There's also provisions related specifically to pandemics and the protections that need to be provided to workers during a peacetime emergency. And so those include things like PPE, sanitizers, cleaning, social distancing, and the like. They also include other things like break times, keeping records of injuries, and then would provide additional paid sick time. So workers would be eligible for 1 hour, or crew, 1 hour of sick time per 30 hours worked. And then they would be required to be able to carry that over if they did not use it. Again, these are the floor, not the ceiling, which means that an employer or a collective bargaining agreement can always provide at least the same or better benefits than what are required. I do want to point out that there is an exception for operations with 50 or fewer workers. So this, all these safety requirements in Section 7 do not apply to operations with 50 or fewer. Finally, Section 8 requires notification by the employer annually, and then an update to employees each year of these safety requirements. And that is the safe workplaces for meat and poultry processing workers.
Any comments or questions, members? Thank you, Ms. James. I will comment briefly. I think if we saw what happened in this past year during the pandemic, our meat and poultry processing workers were, I will hold off here. I see Lead Hamilton has raised his hand. Go ahead, Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, you and I spoke, and I'm trying to, gain a better understanding around all this as well. My question, Ms. James, is on Section 4, starting on lines 203.19, and it talks about the working conditions. And on 203.21, it talks about an unreasonable risk. Who determines whether or not the risk is unreasonable?
Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So it's my interpretation of that section is that the employee has to have a good faith belief of the unreasonable risk. So in that situation, that would be the employee, but they would have to have a good faith belief of the unreasonable risk of illness or injury. And then they would also have to report that, and then nothing happens with the employer. So before they would be able to refuse.
And Mr. Chairman, so Ms. James, if I'm new to the work area, and I'm standing at the spot where I'm, I look to my left, the person working right next to me is holding a large knife. Is that unreasonable risk to my safety, and then I can go home and be paid?
Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. So all of these are going to be a case-by-case analysis, so I can't guarantee exactly how that would play out in any given scenario, but again, it's I think you kind of look at the reasonable person and whether a reasonable worker in the meat processing operation would think that that was an unreasonable risk and that they had reported that to their employer and the employer didn't take action. So if someone had a knife and they told the employer about that and then the person continued to have a knife, possibly. But again, I can't guarantee how that would play out.
And Representative Hamilton, we all know that there's knives and sharp implements that will be used in these processing plants. So go ahead, Representative Hamilton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and that's why I raised the question. Ms. James, you said that that could very well be an issue that an employee could say would be an unreasonable risk. About 2 weeks ago, I toured a packing plant, and everybody was holding a knife. And now, Mr. Chairman, the individual that's walking us through the bill just said that could be an unreasonable risk. And so it comes back to my original question, who determines what is going to be unreasonable? And, the way this is written, my concern is, and Mr. Chairman, you and I share the fact that we want to keep the workers safe. There's no question about that. My question is, or my concern is, the way that this is written, this could be a trial lawyer's they're going to just have a heyday with this. And that's why I'm asking the questions around this. And my other question, Mr. Chairman, is what government entity is not doing the job that we as a legislature has assigned them to do? Because There are nine different government agencies that are assigned to address and regulate packers and processors. And so if we're going to add additional requirements or additional regulations, let's also identify which government agency is not doing the job that they're tasked to do, so we can eliminate them and then bring forth this new proposal versus continuing to add additional stuff. So I would like a little more information on Section 4 as we continue to go forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Any other member questions or comments? Well, Representative Hamilton and members, I think if we saw what has happened, especially this past year with our meat processing plants, especially being put under as being deemed by the federal government as the essential employees they were, and speeding up the lines, that we need to take a look at doing this type of work to make sure that we are protecting our workers. And Representative Hamilton, I appreciate you raising those concerns. When I recently toured one of our meat processing plants here in Minnesota, pre-COVID, I was amazed at that point in time how close together our workers were working that were processing the meat that we all consume every day. And when we saw the line speed up and all that to keep up with production, I think that these kind of accommodations are merited. And I think we should have further conversation about making sure that we are taking care of this very needed part of our economy and our everyday way of life.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I agree, we need to have this conversation because, again, I have friends who work in these packers, processors. And, you know, most of you know, I've been in the business for a long time on the live side, and also saw how it was the live side. I mean, we were putting down live animals and just destroying them. And it was sad. And, you know, all the way around, it was horrendous. Again, I want to make sure that when we're addressing this, that we're doing it in a way that is not going to have those unintended consequences as well. And that's why I'm asking the questions around this, specifically around Section 4. And subsequently, again, with all the government agencies that are assigned to regulate this business, this one in particular, I want to know which one isn't doing their job to keep workers safe. And that way, we as a legislature can address them and make the necessary changes. Because if they're not doing the tasks that they're assigned to do, then we should just eliminate them and bring someone else in. I'll give you an example. When I was serving on the Education Committee and the Health and Human Services Committee, there was a government program where the Education Department was supposed to be talking to the Health Department, and they weren't communicating. So the proposal that was brought forward was to establish a third entity to work with the two to make them communicate. And it was just adding additional layers. And, you know, instead of going to both government agencies and saying, look, we expect you as legislators, we expect you to work together. And so, again, the individuals that are supporting this provision, if you could please bring forward as well what government agencies that are already signed to regulate this industry, which ones are not doing their job so that we can address them as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I believe I'm going to check to see if Department of Labor and Industry, they are on the call. I'm going to see if they have any comments. And then I see Mr. Lopez has a comment, but I don't want to get into a bunch of testifiers getting this out of hand. So I'm going to check with Department of Labor. Commissioner Bussenbach.
Yes.
Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. This is Nicole Blissenbach, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. I guess I can try to address the specific comments. Here at the Department of Labor and Industry, we do have Minnesota OSHA, who is involved in ensuring safe and healthy workplaces for the people of Minnesota and workers of Minnesota. One of the primary issues that we see is OSHA is oftentimes comes in after the fact, right? We receive complaints, we do inspections, we can we respond to fatalities, we respond to serious injuries. But one of the things that we don't necessarily have the resources to do is be proactive. We try to be. We try to target industries where we see higher higher rates of injuries and fatalities, but we don't have the resources to go out and inspect every workplace. So by one of the things this bill does is establish that coordinator, which is an attempt to be proactive, to help identify issues before they become hazards in the workplace for workers. So that is one piece that I did want to point out. The other piece is statute 182.654, subdivision 11 does have a refusal to work under dangerous conditions. What this bill does is kind of expand that and make it a little bit more specific to this work environment. So while there is already the right for employees to refuse to work under certain conditions, this makes it a little bit more specific to the processing plant environment.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Mr. Lopez, I think I'm going to keep the conversation just to members only. Thank you for getting to weigh in, but I don't want to get into back and forth and get this drug out of hand. So thank you, sir. Chair Pratt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I just want to, you know, share similar concerns that Representative Hamilton raised. In some ways, I think targeting by the Department of Labor on some of the meatpacking plants that it received maximum fines. For taking reasonable, what we believe reasonable precautions. We've asked the department for a review of those. I don't believe we've heard back yet. But I think it's important to recognize that we're asking these folks to be on the front line, making sure that we have a stable, reliable, healthy food supply. We want the workers to be safe. We want all the employees to be safe, but there are already whistleblower protections out there. As Representative Hamilton said, these are highly regulated industries. And, I think as we continue discussions on the conference committee work, I think that's, those are issues that will have to be addressed and resolved. But, and I also appreciate you allowing this to be a members only conversation, since we've already taken significant public testimony.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. Any other member questions or comments on any of these house only provisions? Well, thank you, members, for your attention. Tomorrow the gavel goes back to the Senate. Any chair comments on moving forward here in the next couple of days? Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. Members, at this point, we're waiting on joint targets. We've heard that those may be available sometime Friday. I will work with Chairs Eklund and Knorr on potential additional meetings this week, but as of now, I wouldn't expect that we will be meeting tomorrow. And so with that, Chair Eklund, members can plan accordingly.
Chair Knorr, any comments on moving forward?
Thank you so much, Chair Eklund. Chair Pratt indicated, we're waiting for the joint targets. However, we will continue to address some of the small differences in the language that we have so that we can bring those provisions in the coming days. Hopefully we can adopt the non-controversial issues as soon as possible, and then take a deep dive in the conversation that we just had. I know it's important that we focus on the workers and also the employers. We understand the workers are our essential asset that we have, and having a meaningful workplace benefit and also ensuring that workplace safety is really essential for us to really do a good job when it comes to having an equitable economy so that we can all succeed together. With that, Mr. Chair, I don't have any other further comment. We will be the next meeting, which is scheduled since the Senate is canceling the discussion on Wednesday. We will be proceeding the same way to have more thorough conversation on some of the other provisions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Norr. So I advise members to watch their calendars. And with that, we're adjourned.